In other words, there is little positive reinforcement when it comes to behaviors and actions critical to maintaining the circle of safety. Whether intentionally or not, they are designed not only to allow dopamine addiction to happen, but to cultivate and encourage it. And like all addictions, this one has consequences. Our judgment gets cloudy, we become less concerned with outsiders, and selfishness takes hold. We become obsessed with finding our next hit, and we won't let anyone or anything stand in our way. Chapter 23, At Any Expense. There are regulations to manage the drilling of oil so that we can reap the benefits of the resource while also preserving the land from which we extract it. Other regulations keep car and machine emissions in check to ensure that we can have our conveniences and still maintain air quality. This is what good regulations do. They attempt to balance the benefit and the cost of that benefit. It is an inexact science, but few would disagree that imbalance, one way or the other, would be damaging to commerce or our lives. And so the process of trying to maintain the balance continues in earnest. In the early 20th century, the electromagnetic spectrum was viewed as a publicly owned natural resource, and a scarce one at that. With the arrival of radio, the broadcast industry was a bit like the Wild West, with too many broadcasters attempting to be heard on a limited number of wavelengths. And so Congress passed the Radio Act of 1927 to help organize the system. The act was later replaced by the Communications Act of 1934, which also introduced the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, as part of Franklin D. Roosevelt's New Deal. The new act and the new commission also took responsibility for the new medium of television and, as with radio, did the work of helping the broadcast industry grow while also protecting the public's access to information. One of the ways in which the FCC could regulate the limited resource was to require broadcasters to have a license to broadcast on the public spectrum. One of the requirements to obtain a broadcast license was for the networks to provide public service programming for the community from whose airwaves it was profiting. The networks feared they would lose their licenses to operate if they did not comply, and thus was born the evening news. Programming meant to serve the public interest apart from the commercial interest of the rest of the network programming. Though the networks didn't make a lot of money from the news, they did gain something just as important to their businesses, something that money couldn't buy, a reputation for integrity. Walter Cronkite, who served as anchorman of the CBS Evening News from 1962 to 1981, was considered the most trusted man in America, a reputation that clearly benefited the entire CBS organization. Both Cronkite and the other newsmen of the day thought of themselves as having a mission. We were sort of driven during the 1960s by this quasi-religious drive to give people the information they needed to have, says Ted Koppel, the award-winning newsman and former host of Nightline. The news fulfilled an obligation to the public. It was ostensibly the lost leader that permitted NBC, CBS, and ABC to justify the enormous profits made by their entertainment divisions, Koppel explains. It never occurred to the network brass that news programming could be profitable. The system of give and take was balanced. But near the end of 1979, something happened. On November 4th, a group of Islamist students and militants stormed the American embassy in Tehran and took captive 52 Americans. Not long after, ABC News debuted America Held Hostage, the Iran Crisis, a series developed expressly to cover developments in the hostage crisis. Later renamed Nightline, the show Ted Koppel anchored for 25 years, gave Americans an update on the crisis every night of the 444-day ordeal. The program was instantly popular, and for the first time in news history, the network executives took notice. Instead of leaving the news alone to be run by cause-driven, idealistic journalists, they began to see the news as a profit center, and so they started to get more involved. Though programs like 60 Minutes, which had already been on the air for more than a decade, were profitable, they didn't air every night. They weren't the nightly news. What's more, this was a different time. It was now the 1980s. America's wealth and affluence were at an all-time high, and our desire for more wealth and affluence became a force that would drive nearly every facet of life in the country for the decade and beyond, including in broadcast television. Our craving for dopamine was on the rise. The balance was about to tip. With the end of the Iran hostage crisis came the Reagan administration, and with it, a new broadcast sheriff moved into town, newly appointed FCC chairman Mark Fowler. Fowler and many of his supporters saw broadcast television, including television news, as just another business trying to make a buck. With the advent of cable television and the introduction of CNN, the news began to transform from a public service and the jewel in the crown of the networks into a 24-hour opportunity to get more jewels. Any obstacle that stood in the way of the networks achieving another hit had to be eliminated. The job of the regulator was no longer to provide protection, but to help drive profit. One by one, sometimes with the support of Congress and sometimes acting alone, Fowler and the FCC slowly dismantled all the standards to which networks needed to adhere to qualify for a broadcast license, standards that aimed to maintain at least some sense of balance by serving the public good. For starters, the time that networks had to renew their licenses was extended from 3 to 5 years, meaning the old fear of losing a license became less of a concern. The number of stations a single company could own went from 7 to 12, giving each holding company a greater opportunity to try to seize more market share. Any provisions for how much advertising could be carried were also eliminated. Fowler's FCC even went so far as to abolish the guidelines that set the minimum amount of non-entertainment programming a network was required to air as a condition of its ability to profit from the public airwaves. The very purpose of the 1934 Act, to reel in the Wild West of the industry and ensure that each network would also offer a public service, was now destroyed. And it didn't stop there. Perhaps the greatest casualty in the network and TV news business came in 1987 with the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine. The Fairness Doctrine was introduced in 1949 to prevent a broadcaster from using a network to advocate one perspective. The doctrine provided that any broadcaster granted a license by the FCC would, as a condition of its license, agree not only to discuss controversial topics that would be in the interest of the public, but also to ensure that any views expressed would be balanced by opposing voices. With that provision having been eliminated, our modern networks now have the right to take a partisan perspective and be as polarizing as they like, whatever is good for business. What the Committee for the Fair Broadcasting of Controversial Issues in 1973 called indispensable and the single most important requirement of operation in the public interest had been disposed of. The path was now completely cleared for news as a service to be replaced by news as another platform on which to sell advertising. As the pursuit of greater abundance continued throughout the 1980s, the destruction of the industry's trust-building elements seemed unstoppable, and the dopamine flowed. No one disputes the right of a company's leaders to grow their businesses in any way they choose, as long as the means they choose are not harmful to the people they claim to serve. The problem is the news business seems to have forgotten the people it is supposed to serve. If we consider the current state of television news, we get a perfect view of what happens when the drive to be first, or boost ratings, is put ahead of the drive to serve the public interest. Among the worst symptoms is the media's willingness to woefully underreport important stories, while it overindulges in the kinds of stories that it might entertain, but hardly inform. Now more than ever, the mission of delivering information has become the business of delivering news. What has happened is not because of journalists. In fact, a good many of them are still driven by the quasi-religious commitment to reporting the truth that Koppel described. The problem lies with the media executives who see the dissemination of information as part of their business portfolios and not as something driven by mission. These executives quickly defend their products as fulfilling their obligation to provide a public service, but their claims are untenable. It is a clear conflict of interest if they count the Nielsen ratings and set advertising rates accordingly. Like a doctor who prescribes the drugs their patients ask for, and not just the ones they need, Koppel says that news organizations went from delivering the news you need, even if you don't want it, to the news you want, even if you don't need it. He laments the bygone days when being a part of a news organization meant something, when it was more of a noble pursuit than a commercial pursuit, a time when newsrooms made the news interesting instead of what they do today, make interesting news. Whether it is a congressman courting donors instead of spending more time responding to the needs of constituents, or a leader of a company who opts to sell products they know might have harmful ingredients because it is profitable, the race to win has always existed and has always caused problems. In healthy organizations, as in healthy society, the drive to win should not precede the desire to take care of the very people we claim to serve. More, more, more. Before the stock market crashed in 1929, there were 25,000 banks in America. However, so many of them were built on such unstable foundations that roughly half of them went out of business in the years immediately following the crash. In 1933, Congress passed the Glass-Steagall Act, then known as the Banking Act of 1933, in an attempt to curb the excessive risk-taking and the speculation of the banking industry so future generations would not find themselves in the same predicament. In addition to the introduction of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, an independent body that preserves and promotes public confidence in the U.S. financial system, other provisions were instituted to reduce the risk the public and the country would have to bear as the banks looked to advance their own interests. One of the most significant provisions of the Act separated commercial banking from investment banking. Commercial banks exist to offer what would be considered traditional banking services, receiving deposits, cashing checks, offering loans, and so on. Investment banks, in contrast, are able to issue securities to help a client raise capital, as well as offer other services, including the trading of equities, commodities, and other financial instruments. Seeing that commercial banks were depositories for personal and business funds, Congress at the time decided that those funds should be off-limits to any investment bank to use for their own speculative and risk-taking ventures. Unfortunately, the future generations our predecessors were trying to protect were less reluctant to risk the public interest to pave the way for new revenue streams. And so, in 1999, at the height of the dot-com boom, during a time of wild speculation, the majority of the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed. The repeal of the Act was justified, as then-Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers said, to, quote, enable American companies to compete in the new economy, unquote. This is political rhetoric to disguise the true intention, to remove regulations specifically designed to protect the public welfare in order to largely help one industry, banking, get bigger so that one group, bankers, could get more hits of dopamine. If competing in the new economy means creating conditions for stock market crashes, then the politicians and the banking lobbies did a great job. With the Act in place, very few large banks failed between 1933 and 1999. And there have only been three significant stock market crashes in the United States since the crash that caused the Great Depression in 1929. Again, there was one crash in 1973, which is the result of a sudden rise in the oil prices and not a banking crisis. Another in 2000 was due to careless betting on the dot-com bubble. The third crash in 2008 resulted from the excessive speculation and risk-taking on the part of the banking industry, as well as the use of mortgage-backed securities. The conditions for the 2008 crash were fueled by companies like Citigroup, previously a commercial bank, and the American International Group, AIG, an insurance company dealing in securities, a practice that would have been forbidden if the Banking Act of 1933 had not been eviscerated less than a decade before. The repeal of most of Glass-Steagall is one of the most obvious and extreme examples of the attempts of some of the me-first boomers to bend or break the laws in the name of self-gain. It's an example of what happens when our leaders put their interests ahead of those they are supposed to protect. On a side note, the events during the period of destructive abundance all happened under the watchful eye of America's first baby boomer president, Bill Clinton, born August 19th, 1946. Addiction has a terrible way of making us lose sight of reality. Like an addict who wakes up regretting what they did under the influence the night before, there are many of the boomer generation who now look back at the destruction accidentally wrought under their watch. And for some of those in charge at the time, The destruction seems to have had a humbling effect. In an interview with Bloomberg Television in 2010, David Kamansky, the former CEO of Merrill Lynch, who Stanley O'Neill replaced, said that it was a mistake to repeal Glass-Steagall. "Unfortunately, I was one of the people who led the charge to get Glass-Steagall repealed," he said. "Of course, when I was running a firm, I didn't want them to strictly enforce the rules." Kamansky now concedes, "I regret those activities and wish we hadn't done that." John Reed, the former co-CEO of Citigroup Incorporated, also said that it was a bad idea to repeal Glass-Steagall. What is it about former CEOs that they are suddenly able to have a kind of sober clarity we wished they had when they were in charge? I understand that we all have 20/20 hindsight, but don't we pay these leaders for their vision and foresight? Beginning in earnest in the 1980s and 1990s, some members of the boomer generation oversaw the steady dismantling of the very controls that were designed to protect us from excess, imbalance, and addiction in our system. The leaders of companies and leaders in government created a strong inner circle with little regard for the protections that are supposed to be offered to others. Just as leaders of any organization are supposed to look after those in their care, which ultimately makes their organization stronger, leaders of companies are also supposed to consider the care of the environment in which they operate. This includes the economy writ large and even civilized society. The circle of safety built to make as many Americans as possible feel safe is now slowly breaking apart, leaving us exposed to greater danger. It weakens a country just as it weakens a company when we have to focus on protecting ourselves from ourselves instead of working together to protect and advance the country as a whole. And if we think the next generation is equipped to fix the problems of the generation before them, we must remind ourselves that they are dealing with addictions of their own. Chapter 24. The Abstract Generation. The Biggest Losers. This be the verse. They fuck you up, your mum and dad. They may not mean to, but they do. They fill you with the faults they had, and add some extra just for you. But they were fucked up in their turn by fools in old-style hats and coats, who half the time were soppy stern and half at one another's throats. Man hands on misery to man, it deepens like a coastal shelf. Get out as early as you can, and don't have any kids yourself. Philip Larkin's 1971 poem paints a bit of a dreary picture of parenting, but sadly, there is some truth in it. The period of destructive abundance in which we are currently living is due in large part to the good intentions of our parents and their parents before them. The greatest generation, raised during the Great Depression and wartime rationing, wanted to ensure that their children did not suffer or miss out on their youth as they did. This is good. This is what all parents want for their children, to avoid their hardships and prosper. And so that's how the boomers were raised, to believe that they shouldn't have to go without, which, as a philosophy, is perfectly fine and reasonable. But given the size of the generation and the abundance of resources that surrounded them, the philosophy got a little distorted. When you consider the rising wealth and affluence of their childhood, combined for good reasons with the cynicism towards government in the 1970s, followed by the boom years of the 1980s and 1990s, and it's easy to see how the boomers earned their reputation as the me generation. Me before we. Putting the protection of ideas and wealth before the sharing of them is now standard. A New Jersey-based accountant told me that he sees a clear difference between his older clients and his younger ones. "My older clients want to work within the confines of the tax code to do what is fair," he explained. "They are willing to simply pay the tax they owe. The next generation spends a lot of time looking to exploit every loophole and nuance in the tax code to reduce their responsibility to as little as possible." When the boomers started having children of their own, they raised their children to be skeptical of those in charge. "Don't let people get things from you if they aren't willing to compensate you for it," goes the thinking. "Don't let anything stand in the way of what you want." Again, all reasonable philosophies, if the circumstances today were the same as the 1960s and 70s, but they aren't. And so a few good ideas got a little twisted for the boomers' kids. Generations X and Y were taught to believe they could get whatever they want. Gen X, growing up before the internet, interpreted that lesson as putting your head down and getting to work. An overlooked and forgotten generation, Gen Xers didn't really rebel against anything or stand for much in their youth. Sure, there was the Cold War, but it was the nicer, gentler version of the Cold War than existed in the 1960s and 70s. Gen Xers didn't grow up practicing drills at school in case of nuclear attack. Growing up in the 1980s was a good life. The 1990s and the new millennium saw even more boom years. Dot-com, e-commerce, email, e-dating, free overnight shipping, no waiting, get it now. Generation Y is said to have a sense of entitlement. Many employers complain of the demands their entry-level employees often make. But I, as one observer, do not believe it is a sense of entitlement. This generation wants to work hard and is willing to work hard. What we perceive as entitlement is, in fact, impatience. An impatience driven by two things. First is a gross misunderstanding that things like success, money, or happiness come instantly. Even though our messages and books arrive the same day we want them, our careers and fulfillment do not. The second element is more unsettling. It is the result of a horrible short circuit to their internal reward systems. These Gen Yers have grown up in a world in which huge scale is normal, money is valued over service, and technology is used to manage relationships. The economic systems in which they have grown up, ones that prioritize numbers over people, are blindly accepted, as if that's the way it's always been. If steps are not taken to overcome or mitigate the quantity of abstraction in their lives, in time, they may be the biggest losers of their parents' excess. And while Gen Yers may be more affected by the short-circuiting because they grew up in this world, the fact is, none of us are immune. The Distracted Generation. Imagine you are sitting on a plane flying at 35,000 feet and 525 miles per hour from New York to Seattle. It's a calm flight. There's no turbulence. It's a clear day, and the captain predicts the whole flight will be a smooth one. Both the captain and co-pilot are seasoned pilots with many, many years of experience, and the aircraft is equipped with the most modern avionics and warning systems. As required by the FAA, both pilots fly the airline simulator a few times a year to practice dealing with various emergencies. 100 miles away, in a dark room in a building with no windows, sits an air traffic controller with 10 years of experience, looking down a scope, monitoring all the air traffic in his assigned sector. Your flight is currently in his sector. Now imagine that the controller has his cell phone next to him. He's not allowed to make calls while he's on duty, but he can send and receive text messages or access his email. Imagine that he can relay coordinates to a flight, check his messages, relay coordinates to another flight, check his phone again. Seems fair, right? As plain as the nose is on my face, I'm confident that the vast majority of us would not be very comfortable with this scenario. We would prefer that the air traffic controller check his email or send his text messages during his breaks. I think we would all feel much better if access to the internet and a personal cell phone were completely forbidden, which they are. Only because our lives are at stake do we see this example as stark. So if we take the life and death part away, why would we think that we can do our work, check our phones, write a paragraph, send a text, write another paragraph, send another text, without the same damage to our ability to concentrate? Generation Y thinks that because they have grown up with all the technologies, they are better at multitasking. I would venture to argue they are not better at multitasking. What they are better at is being distracted. According to a study at Northwestern University, the number of children and young people diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, shot up 66% between 2000 and 2010. Why the sudden huge spike in a frontal lobe dysfunction over the course of a decade? The Centers for Disease Control defines those with ADHD as often having trouble paying attention or controlling impulsive behaviors, may act without thinking about what the result will be, or being overly active. I would submit that this huge spike is not simply because more people have ADHD than previous generations, though this could be true. nor is it due to an increase in the number of parents having their children tested, though this could also be true. Though there are, of course, many genuine cases of ADHD, the sudden spike may be the result of something as simple as misdiagnosis. What I believe is likely happening, however, is that many more young people are developing an addiction to distraction. An entire generation has become addicted to the dopamine-producing effects of text messages, emails, and other online activities. We know that sometimes our wires can get crossed, and the wrong behaviors can be incentivized. Someone who finds the dopamine and serotonin-releasing effects of alcohol as a teenager can become conditioned to look to alcohol to suppress emotional pain instead of learning to look to people for support. This can show up later in life as alcoholism. In this same way, the dopamine-releasing effects of the bing, buzz, or flash of a cell phone feel good and create the desire and drive to repeat the behavior that produces that feeling. Even if we're in the middle of something, it feels good to check our phones immediately instead of waiting 15 minutes to complete our original task. Once addicted, the craving is insatiable. When the phone dings while we are driving, we must look immediately to see who just sent us a text. When we are trying to get some work done and our phones vibrate across the desk, we break concentration and have to look. If boomers are getting their dopamine from goals oriented around more and bigger, then Gen Y is getting their dopamine from anything that satisfies faster or now. Cigarettes are out, social media is in. It's the drug of the 21st century. At least people who smoke stand outside together. Like alcoholism or drug addiction, this new disease is making our youngest generation impatient at best and at worst feel lonelier and more isolated than the generations before. Where alcohol replaced trusting relationships as a coping mechanism for teenagers who grew up to be alcoholics, so too are the positive affirmations we get from social media and the virtual relationships we maintain replacing real, trusting relationships as coping mechanisms. A side effect could be a generation that struggles to find happiness and fulfillment even more than the generations that preceded them. Though there is a desire to do good, their acculturated impatience means that few will commit time or effort to do one thing long enough to see the effect of service, the thing we know gives a sense of fulfillment. In doing research for this book, I kept meeting amazing, wonderful, smart, driven, and optimistic Gen Yers who were either disillusioned with their entry-level jobs or quitting to find a new job that will allow me to make an impact in the world, discounting the time and energy that is required to do it. It's like they're standing at the foot of a mountain, looking at the effect they want to have or the success they want to feel at the peak. There's nothing wrong with looking for a faster way to scale the mountain. If they want to take a helicopter or invent a climbing machine that gets them up there quicker, more power to them. What they seem to fail to notice, however, is the mountain. The see-it-and-get-it generation has an awareness of where they are standing, and they know where they want to get to. What they can't seem to understand is the journey. The very time-consuming journey. They seem flummoxed when told that things take time. They are happy to give lots of short bursts of energy and effort to things, but commitment and grit come harder. Giving a lot of oneself to a small number of things seems to have been replaced by giving a little bit of oneself to a large number of things. This tendency is exemplified by the way many Gen Yers respond to various social causes. They rallied to share the Kony video with their friends. Many posted pictures of themselves in hoodies to support Trayvon Martin. They texted donations to tsunami relief organizations. There is an intense excitement to do good, to help, to support. Yet after the dopamine hit is felt, it's on to the next. Without giving any significant amount of time or energy, a generation comfortable with abstraction has confused real commitment with symbolic gestures. One brand that offers young, fashionable do-gooders the opportunity to do good without actually doing anything is One Face. Customers can buy a watch in the color that represents the cause of their choice. For example, white to stamp out hunger, or pink to stamp out breast cancer. According to the One Face website, an unspecified portion of profits go to the related charities. The problem is, ask the watch wearer what good they are doing, and they will likely tell you that they are helping to raise awareness. That's the Gen Y catch-all. There is so much talk about awareness or driving the conversation that we fail to notice that talk doesn't solve problems. The investment of time and energy by real human beings does. Justifying such campaigns by saying they put pressure on others to do things only supports my argument that we seem less inclined to offer our own time and energy to do what needs to be done, insisting rather that others do it for us. It also reveals a limitation of the internet. An amazing vehicle for spreading information, the web is great for making people aware of the plight of others, but it is quite limited in its ability to alleviate that plight. The plight of others is not a technology problem, it's a human one, and only humans can solve human problems. As money replaced the expense of time and energy, now brands that offer people the chance to do good by not actually doing anything replace service. Neither fulfills the human need to do real hard work for the benefit of others. Neither fulfills the sacrifice requirements for serotonin or oxytocin. The dopamine drive for instant gratification at best means we, as individuals, keep giving to various causes without ever feeling any sense of belonging or lasting fulfillment. At worst, however, feelings of loneliness and isolation can lead to dangerous, antisocial behavior. The dire scenario. Disappointed and disillusioned, baby boomers are killing themselves in greater numbers than ever before. According to a 2013 study by the Centers for Disease Control, suicide rates among baby boomers rose nearly 30% during the past decade, making suicide one of the leading causes of death in that age group, behind only cancer and heart disease. The biggest jump in suicides was among men in their 50s. This age group experienced a whopping 50% increase. With the increase of suicides among boomers, more people now die of suicide than from car accidents. Unless we do something, my fear is that it's only going to get worse. The problem is that in 20 to 30 years, when our youngest generation grows up and takes charge of government and business, its members will have grown up using Facebook, prescription drugs, or online support groups as their primary coping mechanisms, rather than relying on real support groups, biological bonds of friendship, and loving relationships. I predict we will see a rise in depression, prescription drug abuse, suicide, and other antisocial behaviors. In 1960, the number of notable school shootings was 1. In the 1980s, there were 27. The 1990s saw 58 school shootings. And from 2000 until 2012, there were 102 school shootings. This may seem crazy, but it's an increase of more than 10,000% in just over 50 years. More than 70% of the shooters in all the shootings since 2000 were born after 1980, and a disturbingly high number were around the age of 14 or 15. Though some had diagnosed mental disorders, all felt lonely, outcast, and disassociated from their schools, communities, or families. In almost every case, these young murderers were either victims of bullying themselves or felt ostracized because of their social awkwardness or history of family troubles. Sick gazelles are pushed to the edge of the herd, pushed out of the circle of safety, so the lions might eat the weaker ones instead of the stronger ones. Our primitive mammal brains lead us to the same conclusion. When we feel like we are outside the circle of safety, with no sense of belonging and no sense that others love and care for us, we feel out of control, abandoned, and left for dead. And when we feel that isolated, we become desperate. Virtual relationships can't help solve this problem. In fact, they could be making the situation worse. People who spend excessive time on Facebook frequently become depressed as they compare the perception of their lives with the perception of the lives of others. A 2013 study by social psychologists at the University of Michigan tracked the Facebook use of 82 young adults over a 2-week period. At the start of the study, they rated how satisfied they were with their lives. The researchers then checked in with the subjects every 2 hours, 5 times a day, to see how they were feeling about themselves and how much time they were spending on Facebook. The more time they spent on Facebook since the last check-in, the worse they felt. And at the end of the 2 weeks, the subjects who spent the most time overall on Facebook reported less satisfaction with their lives. Rather than enhancing well-being, the study concluded, interacting with Facebook may predict the opposite result for young adults. It may undermine it. So that's where we stand. The me generation, addicted to performance, dismantled the controls that protect us from corporate abuses and stock market crashes. The distracted generation, living in a world of abstraction, thinks it has ADHD, but more likely has a dopamine-fueled addiction to social media and cell phones. It would seem we have reached the abyss. So what are we to do? The good news is, we are our own best hope. Part 8. Becoming a Leader. Chapter 25. Step 12. It seems our chances look grim. As animals made for cooperation with a need to trust, too many of us are working in environments that bring out the worst in us. We've become cynical, paranoid, selfish, and open to addiction. Our health, and worse, our humanity, are at risk. But we cannot hide behind excuses. We can't blame the media, the internet, or the system. We can't blame the corporations, or Wall Street, or even government anymore. We are not victims of our situation. We are the architects of it. But it isn't dangers outside that will see our demise. Those dangers are constant and will never go away. Civilizations don't usually die from murder, to paraphrase the famous British historian Arnold Toynbee. Civilizations die from suicide. It is the increasing dangers inside our organizations that threaten us most, and fortunately, those dangers are well within our control. For over 75 years, Alcoholics Anonymous has successfully helped people beat the dopamine addiction of alcoholism. Most of us have heard of their 12-step program to recovery, and most of us know the first step, admitting we have a problem. We admit that a good too many of our organizational cultures have a systemic addiction to performance and making the numbers. An addiction, like all addictions, that offers fleeting highs and often comes at significant cost to our health and our relationships. Further complicating our addiction is our ability to raise our status with celebrity or wealth alone, ignoring the anthropological requirements of alpha status. But admitting we have an addiction is only step one. Now, as in Alcoholics Anonymous, we begin the hard work of recovery. We need to do the work and make the sacrifices required to change the systems that pit us against each other and build new ones that inspire us to help each other, something we will not be able to do alone. "You want to know the whole secret to AA?" John, a recovering alcoholic, asked me. "You want to know who actually gets sober and who doesn't?" Few, if any, of the alcoholics enrolled in AA will find sobriety until they complete step 12. Even if they make it through all the other 11 steps, those who do not complete step 12 are very likely to drink again. It is those who complete step 12 who overcome the addiction. Step 12 is the commitment to help another alcoholic beat the disease. Step 12 is all about service. And it is service that is the key to breaking our dopamine addictions in our organizations too. I'm not talking about serving our customers, employees, or shareholders. I'm not talking about abstractions of people. I mean service to the real, living, knowable human beings with whom we work every day. There is a reason why AA meetings happen in church basements and recreational centers, and not in online chat rooms. And there is a reason why, when an alcoholic wants to reach out to their sponsor, the other alcoholic committed to helping them, they don't send them an email. They pick up the phone and call. It's because the connections required to beat addiction must be real. They cannot be virtual. The whole purpose of AA meetings is to make people feel safe. The people who share the struggle, who come together to help and be helped, are warm and friendly and welcoming. For many alcoholics, the connections last well after the meetings are over. As John told me, the connections he made helped him feel less alone and the stories he heard gave him hope. Alcoholism is like a pack of wolves trying to attack you, John says. If you get in the program and stay in the group, then you won't be attacked. The group will keep you safe. In other words, Alcoholics Anonymous is like a family, a tribe, or a platoon. It is Aesop's oxen standing tail to tail, protecting one another from the lion. Alcoholics Anonymous is a perfectly formed circle of safety. In Oxytocin, we trust. Confronting the threats we face in the world cannot be done alone, at least not very effectively. It takes the help and support of others, others who believe in us. Just as dopamine-addicted companies won't be able to self-regulate, addicts who try to follow the steps themselves, who try to monitor their own progress, usually fail. Alcoholics don't succeed just for themselves. They also want to succeed for the person who gives their time and energy to their success, their sponsor. This is how serotonin is supposed to work. It doesn't just raise our status. It reinforces caring, mentoring relationships. And then there is oxytocin. Those feelings of trust and love, all those warm and fuzzies, as it turns out, are critical to helping us beat addiction. Preliminary findings from a 2012 study conducted by researchers in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill show that the presence of oxytocin actually fights withdrawal symptoms in alcoholics and heroin addicts. There is evidence, in fact, that increased levels of oxytocin may even prevent physical dependence from happening in the first place. The evidence is strong that a healthy release of oxytocin through acts of service, sacrifice, and selflessness on behalf of others might actually reduce the possibility of a corporate culture becoming toxic in the first place. Oxytocin is so powerful that the bonds of trust and love we form not only help us beat or ward off addiction, they actually help us live longer. According to another 2012 study, this one conducted by Duke University Medical Center, couples live significantly longer than single people. The Duke investigators found that individuals who never married were more than twice as likely to die during midlife than individuals who were married throughout their adult life. Other studies have shown that married couples have lower levels of cancer and heart disease. Close, trusting relationships don't only protect us at home, they protect us at work too. In cultures like the Marine Corps, in which the bonds of trust run deep, the intangibles, as the Marines call them, actually help maintain the strength of the system and its high level of integrity. It is much harder to become addicted to dopamine in a system in which trust and love run rampant. The more oxytocin there is, the stronger the bonds of trust will be, the greater the risks people will take to do the right thing, the more they will look out for each other, and the better the group will ultimately perform. A circle of safety is kept strong by those who live and work within it. Ask anyone who has made it through any sort of setback, depression, loneliness, failure, getting fired, a death in the family, the loss of a relationship, addiction, legal conflict, victimization by crime, anything, how they made it through? In nearly 100% of the cases, they will say something to the effect of, "I could not have done it without the support of," as they go on to say the name of a family member, close friend, or sometimes even a giving stranger. Consider that those of us who have ever suffered abominable service on an airline have found solace when we turn to the stranger next to us to talk about how we are being treated. Anyone who has ever been subjected to the ambitions of an egomaniacal boss have found comfort in the person at work who is suffering the same. The person we meet who has a family member suffering from the same disease as someone close to us is someone with whom we bond. It is the group of people with whom we find common interest and common cause that we turn to for support. Whenever there is a human bond involved, a real, true, honest human bond, where neither party wants anything from the other, we seem to find the strength to endure and the strength to help. We can put up with a great many hardships when we have a partner to help see us through. In fact, it not only makes the hardships feel easier to endure, but it actually helps us manage the stress and the anxiety. Cortisol can't work its black magic when we have someone by our side. The only reason people like Johnny Bravo, or any soldier, sailor, airman, or marine, are willing to risk their lives for the person to the left or right of them is because they have the utmost confidence that the person to their side would do the same for them. Chapter 26. Shared Struggle. Want not, waste anyway. We in the developed world are generally not working to survive. We have more than enough of everything we need, so much so that we can actually afford to waste it. According to a 2004 study by Timothy Jones, an anthropologist at the University of Arizona in Tucson, as much as 50% of ready-to-harvest food will never be eaten. In fact, the average American household wastes 14% of food purchases, 15% of which are products that have not yet expired. Translated into dollars, the average American family is throwing out nearly $600 per year in meat, fruits, vegetables, and grain products. Simply learning to preserve or freeze more food could save families nearly $43 billion per year. The developing world also loses about the same as the United States, but not because they throw stuff out. According to the Stockholm International Water Institute, as much as 50% of post-harvest food grains will never be eaten simply because of spoilage and improper storage. The developing world loses 50% of its food supply because people aren't looking after it properly, while we, the developed world, lose 50% of our food because we throw it out unnecessarily. This is the burden of having too much. It's easy to spend or dispose of what we do not need when there is plenty more available. Our prodigal ways are not a new phenomenon. That's how our Paleolithic ancestors lived. One of the theories as to why Homo sapiens started farming was that they weren't very careful about the resources they had available to them in the first place. One could say, we've been wasting what we have since the beginning, and we only adapt when we can't afford to waste any more. These days, too many leaders of organizations seem to be wasting the goodwill of people. I wonder how long that can last until they can't afford to do it anymore. If we simply measure the amount of food or energy Americans throw out, how much money we spend wantonly, that should give us an indication of how little we actually need. And that may be our biggest challenge, the fact that, as a society, we feel no burden. Feeling a shared common burden is one of the things that brings us together. Less hardship means less of a need to cooperate, which means less oxytocin. Few of us volunteer to help people in need before the natural disaster, only after it. In this day and age, there is an abundance of food, resources, and choices. The number of products on offer at a supermarket, or the availability of something like electricity, are things our society takes for granted. This is what commoditization is. It is when a resource becomes so ubiquitous that it loses its perceived value. Computers used to be amazing special tools. Companies like Dell built huge businesses on the remarkable value of these machines. However, as supplies increased and prices came down, the products became commoditized, and with it, our appreciation for how remarkable these tools are in our lives diminished. Abundance destroys value. It is not when things come easily that we appreciate them, but when we have to work hard for them, or when they are hard to get, that those things have greater value to us. Be it a diamond deep in the ground, career success, or a relationship, it is the struggle it takes to make it work that helps give that thing its value. Our best days at work. When asked, what was one of your best days at work? Very few of us recount the time everything went smoothly, and the big project we were working on came in on time and under budget. Considering how we work so hard to make things go well, that example should count as a pretty good day at work. But strangely, the days everything goes smoothly and as planned are not the ones we remember with fondness. For most of us, we have warmer feelings for the projects we worked on where everything seemed to go wrong. We remember how the group stayed at work until 3 a.m., ate cold pizza, and barely made the deadline. Those are the experiences we remember as some of our best days at work. It was not because of the hardship per se, but because the hardship was shared. It's not the work we remember with fondness, but the camaraderie, how the group came together to get things done. And the reason is, once again, natural. In an effort to get us to help one another during times of struggle, our bodies release oxytocin. In other words, when we share the hardship, we biologically grow closer. You may be getting sick of me saying this over and over, but our bodies are trying to incentivize us to repeat behavior in our best interest. And in hard times, what better way to protect the tribe, organization, or species than to make us feel good for helping one another? Our best days at work were the ones where we helped each other endure and overcome hardship. And if those days do not come with fun memories, it is probably because the team didn't come together and backstabbing and selfishness prevailed. When we work in a culture in which we are left to fend for ourselves, even a good day at work, from a biological perspective, is still a bad day at work. Those in the military often speak of fondness for their time deployed. It seems strange that a group living in austere conditions with real threats of danger would have fond memories of these times. They probably won't say they enjoyed it. They might even say they hated it. But a surprisingly high number will say that they were grateful for the experience. This is the result of the oxytocin we feel, knowing that we made it through thanks to the help of others. And those relationships help us manage the hardships when we come back too. Contrary to popular belief, those who deploy actually commit suicide at slightly lower rates than those who stayed back. One theory is that those who did not deploy often have a hard time coping with being alone while their team goes off to face external dangers together. In times when resources are scarce and danger is looming, we naturally come together. This is why the four major uniformed services work so well together in a combat situation, but bicker like spoiled children back at the Pentagon. In combat, when uncertainty is high and the external threats are real, they work together to increase the chances of survival and success. In contrast, back at the Pentagon, where losing huge sums of money is the biggest threat they face, the leaders of each service all too often work against one another in the name of protecting or advancing their own interests. Common are the stories in combat of a person who sacrifices themselves to help another person, regardless of uniform. Rare are the stories in the Pentagon of one service sacrificing to help another uniformed service get what they need. If our species thrives when we are forced to work together to manage through hardship, then what we need to do is redefine hardship for our modern age of abundance. We need to learn to readapt, to understand how to operate as we are designed within these complicating conditions. To the relief of many listeners, we do not need to give up our abundance and live a monk's life to do this. Our challenge is that our visions of the future are confined to our means. We need to reframe our visions to outsize the resources we have to realize them. Redefining the struggle. It is no accident that small businesses so often run innovation circles around large corporations. Though almost all large corporations today started small and innovative, they seem to lose their ability to innovate when they get big. About the only way big companies, flush with resources, seem to innovate these days is when they buy smaller companies that have the big ideas. Have none of the leaders of large corporations stopped to wonder why smaller, less resourced companies, staffed by a smaller group of people struggling together, are the ones who usually come up with all the latest innovations? Size and resources are not necessarily the advantage. Sharing a struggle for limited resources and working with people who are intent on building something out of nothing is a good formula for a small business. But recreating those conditions is extremely difficult for organizations that have already suffered together and succeeded. This is one of the reasons we find Apple such a fascinating company. It has repeated its success multiple times, from the Apple I and II to the Macintosh and the iMac, from the iPod and iTunes to the iPhone. Instead of just looking for new ways to sell old products, which is largely what most successful companies do, they invented new products and competed in new industries. We know that our species is not built for abundance, and that our internal systems can short-circuit when we're in environments of abundance. We know that we are at greater risk of succumbing to the addictive qualities of short-term dopamine-driven incentive structures in our companies if the chemicals that influence our behavior are out of balance. We also know that we won't pull together until the oxytocin and serotonin are able to flow more easily. Leaders of successful organizations, if they wish to innovate or command loyalty and love from their people, must reframe the struggles their companies face not in absolute terms, but in terms relative to their success. In other words, the dangers and opportunities that exist outside the circle of safety should be exaggerated to suit the size of the organization itself. Let me explain. A small company struggles because it does not have the resources to guarantee it will stay alive. Survival is a real concern. It is how well the people pull together to outthink their problems that often makes the difference between success and failure. Trying to buy one's way out of problems is less effective and unsustainable. A larger, more successful company, in contrast, doesn't fear for its life because it is flush with resources. Survival is not the motivator. Growth is. But we already know that growth is an abstract and non-specific destination that doesn't ignite the human spirit. What ignites the human spirit is when the leaders of our organizations offer us a reason to grow. Aiming for the quarter or the year just isn't compelling. It doesn't offer much of a struggle. That's not to say it's easy. It may or may not be. But the resources are readily available for the company to accomplish such goals, or come close. To really inspire us, we need a challenge that outsizes the resources available. We need a vision of the world that does not yet exist, a reason to come to work, not just a big goal to achieve. This is what leaders of great organizations do. They frame the challenge in terms so daunting that literally no one yet knows what to do or how to solve it. Bill Gates set Microsoft on a path to put a PC on every desk. What happened to that vision? Though Microsoft may have largely achieved its goal in the developed world, the goal is still a long, long way from being accomplished. Like a small business, if a large organization can frame their challenge relative to their existing capacity, the people will figure it out. That's where innovation comes from. Sadly, due in large part to the poor leadership of Steve Ballmer, an inclination to throw money at problems and sacrifice people when necessary, the leaders of Microsoft sabotaged the very conditions required to drive the innovation they sought. Steve Jobs set out, in his words, to put a dent in the universe. More practically stated, he believed that the way for us to truly capture the full value of technology is to adapt the technology to fit the way we live our lives, instead of requiring that we adapt our lives to fit the way the technology works. This explains why intuitive interfaces and simplicity were key to helping him advance his vision. If the leaders of organizations give their people something to believe in, if they offer their people a challenge that outsizes their resources but not their intellect, the people will give everything they've got to solve the problem. And in the process, not only will they invent and advance the company, they may even change an industry or the world in the process, just as an early version of Microsoft did. But if the resources are vastly greater than the problem before us, then the abundance works against us. Though it may take small steps to make a big leap, it is the vision of the big leap and not the action of the small steps that inspires us. And only after we have committed ourselves to that vision can we look back at our lives and say to ourselves that the work we did mattered. The value of purpose. Stanley Milgram's authority and obedience experiment from the 1960s showed that those with a belief in a higher authority were much less likely to follow orders they suspected could harm others than those who did not. In every variance of the experiment, it was the volunteers who did not see the scientist as the ultimate authority who refused to go all the way. It was their adherence to a higher purpose that gave them the strength not to follow orders blindly. In the case of our businesses, neither our bosses nor our clients are the ultimate authorities over us. And in the case of public companies, nor are the shareholders or Wall Street analysts. And believe it or not, a small company does not answer ultimately to its investors either. All these authorities are Milgram's scientists in white lab coats. Authorities in the situation, perhaps, but not ultimate authorities over the decisions we make. Just as Milgram's study would have us predict, those leaders and companies with a strong sense of why, a strong sense of purpose, and courage enough to stand up to the pressure of Wall Street or abstract shareholders are the ones that do better in the long term. Bob Chapman works hard to ensure his company remains profitable and continues to grow, but he sees profit as simply a means by which he can serve the people who work at Barry Waymiller. Profit, in his mind, is a fuel, not a destination. Chapman answers to a higher authority and feels a responsibility to look after the sons and daughters who are in the care of his company. Chapman has the courage to ignore those who would demand he make short-term decisions simply to make the numbers work. Jim Sinegal of Costco believed he had a greater responsibility to the people who worked for his company than to those who simply profited from their labor. A leader of Marines is taught to put the Marines in their charge before themselves. Every CEO of Southwest Airlines has known that their first responsibility is to their people. Serve them and they will serve the customer, who will ultimately drive the business and benefit the stakeholders, in that order. These remarkable leaders and all those who work in their organizations believe they serve a cause rather than an outsider with selfish motives. And that cause is always human. Everyone knows why they come to work. When a company declares that its cause is to become a global leader, or to become a household name, or to make the best products, those are selfish desires with no intended value to anyone beyond the company itself, and often not even everyone in the company. Those causes can't inspire humans, because those causes aren't causes. No one wakes up in the morning inspired to champion that. In other words, none of them is a cause bigger than the company. Human beings have thrived for 50,000 years, not because we are driven to serve ourselves, but because we are inspired to serve others. That's the value of step 12. All we need are leaders to give us a good reason to commit ourselves to each other. Chapter 27. We Need More Leaders. Johnny Bravo, the A-10 pilot who believed that his greatest asset was the empathy he had for the men on the ground, learned what it really takes to be a leader a few years after his experience in Afghanistan. It was after he landed his plane following a training mission in the Nevada desert. His crew chief, the airman assigned to look after his aircraft, came over to greet him and help him out of his jet. On that day, the crew chief was off his game and distracted, and Johnny Bravo snapped at him. He expects the people around him to be at their best so he can be at his best and support those on the ground. His crew chief apologized. He was tired because he didn't get enough sleep, he explained. He was going to night school, and he and his wife had a new baby who kept them up at night. And it was at that moment that Johnny Bravo realized that empathy is not something we give to the nameless, faceless people we aim to serve. Empathy is not something we offer to our customers or our employees from 9 to 5. Empathy is, as Johnny Bravo explains, a second-by-second, minute-by-minute service that we owe to everyone if we want to call ourselves a leader. Leadership is not a license to do less. It is a responsibility to do more. And that's the trouble. Leadership takes work. It takes time and energy. The effects are not always easily measured, and they are not always immediate. Leadership is always a commitment to human beings. People like me write these polemics with the hope that we can somehow influence some change for the greater good, which includes the good of our society's commercial interests. And though many of you who hear these books and articles may even agree with them, leaders of organizations are not clamoring to change the status quo. The data prove that when we lead our organizations, like Charlie Kim, Bob Chapman, Jim Sinegal, Captain David Marquet, or Representatives Robert Goodlatte and Stephanie Herseth-Sandlin, the tangible, measurable benefits are actually greater than the norm. Yet the theories espoused by the likes of Milton Friedman and pioneered by executives like Jack Welch continue to be the gospel. Many leaders today prefer Jack Welch's approach to running a business over Jim Sinegal's theory on how to lead people simply because it offers more of a thrill. Senegal's style may not come with a roller coaster, but it is stable, and it sets up the company to succeed in a more steady way. In contrast, Welch's style is much more like gambling. Ups and downs, wins and losses, thrilling, exciting, bright lights, high intensity, Vegas. If you have enough money to keep playing through the lows, then you could hit the jackpot. But if you can't afford to play for long, if you're not sure you can time your exit just right, or if you are looking for something sustainable and stable, then you would probably prefer to invest in a company with a strong circle of safety. Having a few roller coaster companies in an economy is fine and good, but when there are a high number of leaders who put the thrill of a dopamine hit over the hard work of looking after people, the entire economy becomes unbalanced. Everything about being a leader is like being a parent. It's about committing to the well-being of those in our care and having a willingness to make sacrifices to see their interests advanced so they may carry our banner long after we are gone. Sir Isaac Newton, the 17th century English physicist, offered as his second law of motion the formula F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. When the mass we aim to move is great, we must apply more force. If we wish to change the direction of a large company or solve a large problem, we need to apply a huge force. And this is often what we do. We have a big repositioning or a big reorg. The trouble with applying large force to anything, however, is it rattles us. We fear it may cause more harm than good. It undermines the circle of safety. However, there is another variable that we often neglect, the A for acceleration. Who says the change has to be sudden or instantaneous? Bob Chapman, Charlie Kim, Captain David Marquet, and others did not march in with new theories and start dismantling their organizations. They tinkered. They applied small changes. They experimented. Some of their experiments worked, some didn't. And in time, momentum built up, the changes added up, and the organizations and the people within them were transformed. Leadership, true leadership, is not the bastion of those who sit at the top. It is the responsibility of anyone who belongs to the group. Though those with formal rank may have authority to work at greater scale, each of us has a responsibility to keep the circle of safety strong. We must all start today to do little things for the good of others. One day at a time. Let us all be the leaders we wish we had. If this book inspired you, please pass it on to someone you want to inspire.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Leaders Eat Last, Why Some Teams Pull Together and Others Don't, by Simon Sinek. Copyright 2013 by Simon Sinek. Performed by the author. Directed by Arthur Morey. Performance copyright 2013 by Brilliance Audio. All rights reserved. Recorded by arrangement with Portfolio, a member of Penguin Group, USA, LLC. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance Audio titles, please call the following toll-free number. 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.